Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Rosemary. And today I'm going to talk about a very simple question. Very simple question. I first heard about this question from Martine Batchelor. This was 12 years ago last week. I met Martine Batchelor at a conference, and she was telling a story about having been a nun in a Korean monastery. And the head of the monastery gave all the monks and nuns one question, along with their zazen practice. Gee. And their question was, who is this? The question was, what is this? And sometimes it's translated as, what is it? But that's the question. And the idea, she told us, was that they would just carry that question around with them all the time. And whenever they encountered something, they would ask themselves, what is it? When they're on the cushion, if something arose in their minds, they'd ask themselves, what is it? And I was really taken with this question. So off and on since then, I can't say that I've practiced it like a cloistered Korean Zen monk or nun might, but it's a very interesting question to carry around and ask yourself sometimes. When you use it on the cushion, when you're sitting, when you're meditating, and you're working with this question, it's both a concentration practice, it's a practice that keeps you right where you are, and it's also a kind of an open inquiry. So when you ask it, you're asking the question without striving for an answer, particularly, or a particular answer. The important part, as they say, is the question mark. Just the question mark. You're not looking for some answer that comes in a box that's tied up in a ribbon. If you get it, don't tell me about it. I'll be jealous. And then what'll I do? I'll get a whole talk out of that. Yeah, if you get the answer tied up in a ribbon, please come tell me. So when you're sitting on the cushion, when you're meditating with this question, what is it? I'll tell you what it's not. It's not a mantra. It's not, you know, you don't sit there asking yourself over and over and over and over, what is it? Just when you find yourself wandering off, you bring yourself back with that question. And you ask it without developing a monologue about it. So, what is it? Oh, it's a robin. Or maybe, what is it? Well, it's sadness. Or you might go for, no, it's loneliness, you know. But then, kind of let it go and let it be. Although you might also ask yourself, what is it that's feeling lonely? If you want to take a philosophical turn with it, you might ask, what is it that's feeling lonely? Or maybe, who is it that's feeling lonely? And the question came from a story in the Platform Sutra of Wei Neng. And Wei Neng was the guy who entered the monastery as an illiterate kitchen boy and ended up besting the highest rank monk to become the heir of the abbot, which caused a little bit of commotion during the ranks. But he had to leave for a while. But he came back And at this point in the story, he's the abbot of the monastery. So here's the story. A monk once visited the sixth ancestor. The sixth ancestor is Wei Nung. He's the sixth Zen teacher in Chan teacher in China. And this monk who visited him was one of the senior, very well thought of monks at Monk's Mount Song Monastery. He was the senior, sort of the best and the brightest at that monastery. And he had been there for a long time and done the practices and studied with the teacher there. And this would happen a lot of times. A teacher would say, you know, you're really ripe. I think let's send you over to so-and-so to study for a while. Or I've taught you everything I can. Let's send you over to so-and-so. And probably, they never say this, but probably, I really want to get rid of you. Let's send you over to so-and-so for a while. That didn't get recorded in the stories because it was the abbots, I think, who wrote the stories. But anyway, the monk once visited the sixth ancestor. And Wei Nung asked him, where are you from? And the monk said, I came from Mount Song. Some of the translations say, I came from Mount Song Monastery. The ancestor said, what is this that thus comes? Sometimes it's translated, what is this and how did it get here? And the monk could not answer and remained speechless. He practiced there for 8 years with Wei Nung until he understood. We'll get to the understood later on. But so Wei Nung asked him, where are you from? And he says, you know, where he came from. And then when he asks him, what is this? Wei Nung is not asking him, so tell me about yourself. You know, what kind of people do you come from? Where'd you go to school? Are you good at sports? He's not asking him anything like that. He doesn't accept just anybody into his monastery. And so he uses these questions to sort of sort them out, sort of maybe scare off the ones who don't really want to be there. But I really like to imagine that he is asking this question just kind of idly. Just idly asking this question. Now that's heresy, because none of these koans and stories, nowhere in them does anyone ever ask an idle question. But I like to imagine that Wei Nung is just Wei Nung is asking him just very idly, what is this I, and what is this Mount Song? You know, I mean, it's almost kind of a fun, one of those kind of fun Zen questions. So, so the monk knew that the answer wasn't a description of Mount Song. He knew that he wasn't going to get away with describing how tall the mountain was, or it's the one over next to Mount Li. It's the second tallest one in the mountain range. It's got a snow cap, you know. He knows that's what Wei Nung wasn't asking. Wei Nung, I think, might have even been asking, are you bragging about coming from Mount Song Monastery? You know, who knows? He might have been asking that. And the part of it's that, who is this I? Wei Nung is asking him, are you saying that there's a permanent, eternal, independent, unchanging core solid self? And he knows the answer is not, yeah, that's it. But he has, you know, he is completely flabbergasted and doesn't know what to say. The answer to it is it's too elusive to both sides of that question. Well, there's three sides of that question. What are you? where did you come from and how did you get here? It's too elusive to just give him the snappy answer that he knows that he wants. There's a book that was published, I don't know, sometime 5 years ago or 10 years ago. It's called Prairie Earth by William Least Heat Moon. And it's a book about a particular little part of the Kansas tallgrass prairie. I think it's one county. And he spends the whole book talking about that piece of land. You know, he talks about the geology of it. He talks about the physical history of it. He talks about each and every tribe of humans that ever settled it. He talks about the political history. He talks about the fence posts. He talks about the arrowheads. I mean, they called it a deep history or a horizontal history. And the people who lived there, when they saw the book, they were just really astonished because they thought, you know, as we all would, this is just where I live. Nobody had any idea that you could write a book that thick about it. And even so, he couldn't encompass what that little chunk of prairie was. And if he wanted to write the book again today, it would probably have to have another volume just as large to describe it. So Wei Nung, or the monk, actually, the monk knew that, you know, he could go off and write a book about what Mount Song is and what this I is, and he knew that he would never be able to encapsulate it. So he knew that he had to answer the question some other way. And that's what he did for his 8 years in the monastery. He pondered that question, what is it? What is it? When I first started practicing, I think probably it had been about a year or a year and a half, we had a very well respected Zen teacher come into town to lead a retreat, and we were all very excited, and it was a wonderful retreat. And one of the things that you do in a Zen retreat is you go to Doksan. You have a private meeting with the teacher, right? And I didn't really want to go because I didn't have a question. You should go in there with a question, I thought. And I thought it had to be a really good one, really good Zen question. And I had nothing. And so I wasn't going to go, but someone talked me into it. And I went in, not knowing what to say, and I sat down in front of him. And he was about, you know, he was sitting about that far away. And I said, I don't understand what it means to have no separate self. I said, you know, it's pretty clear to me that my body ends right here, and there's a gap of air, and then there's your body. And this body feels pretty solid and pretty separate. And, you know, can you explain that to me? And he said something like, well, I think you ought to look really deeply into that solidity and that separation. And I said thanks and walked out, and I was like, I have no idea what I'm supposed to do with that. What am I supposed to do with that? And then after the retreat, everybody else was telling me, wow, it was so great, you know. I went in with this really important question, and I got this really good, and I'm going, that was no help to me at all. I was really, really disappointed. And I think that points up, for one thing, the usefulness of having an ongoing relationship with a teacher. Because if I could have gone back to him a couple of weeks later or a month later, and if I'd had the wits about me to go back and say, you know, I didn't understand that. Could you help me? Could you, like, twist that a little bit for me? Because you couldn't go to another teacher and say, oh, so-and-so said this. Why did he say that? Because they would tell you, I don't know why he said that. Go ask him. But he's in California now. I can't ask him. So anyway, if I had been able to go back to him a few weeks later, you know, he might have said something like, well, have you been looking at that? And I would have probably not admitted no because it was so dumb. But he probably would have said something like, so you've been studying that. Have you seen any chinks in it? Have you seen any cracks in that solid self? He might have asked, when does it feel most solid? When does your self feel most solid? When does it feel kind of like a clenched fist? Are there times when it feels like that? He might have asked, when does it feel the least solid? When does the self feel much more like a liquid? And how do those two things feel different? Does one feel better than the other one? You know, under what circumstances do you find yourself feeling separate versus feeling connected? And I think even at that point, even I would have gotten it enough to know what to do with that. So I recommend that if you're going to ask questions that you don't really care about but turn out to be big questions, you should have an ongoing relationship with the person that you're asking them of. Or you'd be a better Zen student than I was. So in the years since then, when I talk to people, one thing that I've noticed is that people seem to feel that solid, separate ego self when afflictive emotions arise. And there are three afflictive emotions in particular that seem to add to that feeling. One's anger, another one's embarrassment, and the other one is defensiveness. In a moment, I think particularly defensiveness. In a moment when you're feeling very defensive, just by the nature of what defensiveness is, you have to be feeling like you have something you have to defend, right? And so it lends itself to this feeling, this kind of self-righteous, this I, this gotta protect it, this kind of very me versus you kind of feeling. And at times like that, in my experience, it does not help very much to say to yourself, what is it that's feeling defensive? Or when you're really angry, what is it that's feeling angry? Well, it's the thing that just got a lot angrier. What would happen? You know, I think later on, after the heat of the emotion has cooled down, you can start asking those kind of questions. What was that exactly that needed defending? What was that that was angry? Or if something makes you angry one time and not another, ask yourself what the difference was between those two selves. The one that got angry when it got cut off in traffic and the one that didn't. You know, and you can try it at the time, but it might or might not be helpful in the moment. So that's when I've noticed for myself and from other people when the self feels the most solid. And when I found that the least solidity of the self, or one time, has to do with grief a lot of times. So at a funeral of someone who's much beloved, you can sort of feel everyone in, you don't feel separate from everybody else in the room. You're all united in this sort of universal feeling of grief, you know? And there's your Uncle Bob over there, and you have never liked him because he has just obnoxious political views and he's happy to share them, you know? But in that moment of being in, you know, in that hour, whatever it is, of being in that funeral, with all the grieving relatives and everybody, there's a much shorter distance, you know, between you and Uncle Bob, I find. When people leave, when we, Dave and I, Dave, when I was a kid, we never lived around my family, right? And as an adult, Dave and I don't live around any of our families either. The closest family is 6 hours away. And so when we see them, it's a big deal. So whenever anyone comes to stay with us, whenever someone that we don't get to see very often, who we really love, comes to stay with us, whenever they leave, there I am out on the porch waving goodbye, sobbing. And it's gotten to be a thing with my kids. There's Mom. You know, one, two, three, Mom's crying. And it's funny because, you know, I come from this huge family. I don't think anybody else does that but me. You know, my mom doesn't do that. None of her sisters do that. You know. But my grandma did. My mother's mother used to cry when we left. And so when I'm standing out on the porch waving goodbye to my kids or my mom or my brother, you know, it really does not feel in that moment like it's me standing out on the porch waving goodbye and crying. It feels like it's grandma doing it. And if I really asked myself at that moment, which I wouldn't, but if I did, if I asked myself, so what is this? Who is this that's crying? First I would think, well, it's grandma crying. But then I might think, no, it's not grandma either. You know, I wonder if grandma's mother cried. I wonder if her grandmother cried. And eventually you could expand that into this is the female ancestors crying. Sorry, guys. I mean, I know you're in there. It's like when you say mankind. You're included in the female ancestors. But it feels like the tears of all mothers who are having to say goodbye. And it's a very connected. You can't find a self in that. So if I asked myself at that time, what is it that's crying? There would just be sort of no end to the answer. It'd be the universe is crying, the tears are crying. So that's an example of not being able to find that separate self, a feeling that not aloneness. And a wonderful thing about that, about those kinds of times, is those times where you see that kind of, where you feel that kind of interconnection, is that at times like that is when you can touch compassion. You know, it's out of those times when the universe is crying, the compassion arises. It doesn't arise out of separation, but when we can drop or lose or let go of that sense that separate sense of an independent I. So that's one of the wonderful fruits of that. So this practice of questioning, what is it? All kinds of things might arise out of it that you never would have thought of, that you never would have thought of before you started. So Wei Nung was expecting an answer from that monk. I think he probably wasn't expecting one right there and then. But I think eventually he did expect to get an answer. And that's part of the deal with a koan. That's part of the expected storyline of a koan, is that you don't have an answer right then, but eventually you do have an answer. But we don't, when we're asking what is it, we aren't really, we aren't searching for, certainly not for an intellectual answer. We're not even really doing it searching for an answer. We're just asking ourselves, what is it? If we do take up a koan, when I find a koan that I'm interested in, one that kind of grabs me, the first thing that I do, and I'd be interested if other people do this too, the first thing I do is I try to solve it with logic. You know, what was your face before your grandparents were born? The first thing I try to work through is the genetics of that. You know, because you have to be able to grab onto it somewhere, right? So I'll try to work with it with logic. And do that until it fails, and it always does. And at that point, when the logic fails, that's when the real inquiry begins. That's when you really start to be able to ask the questions. We don't really need to limit it to what is this self. This self, what is this I? You know, we can ask it about anything that's happening. One of the wonderful things about doing a retreat here is when we take breaks and we go get a cup of tea, we walk out onto the porch. And when you're in retreat for a few days and you walk out on the porch, there's a lake out there, and there's trees out there, and there's a sky out there, and you know, there's sunshine or there's clouds. But the thing is, you notice all of it, all of it. What is it? You can name 100 things that are out there. You're so opened up, and you have this sense of awe. In contrast to that, last Friday morning, I was sitting out on the porch sewing roxas with a few people, and it was warm, and so I remember that I opened the window. We were there for about 2.5 hours, and I do not recall looking at the lake once. So there are other times when you aren't noticing the world around you at all. On the other hand, I did notice that we were sewing Buddha's robe. And I did notice that I was sewing Buddha's robe with Buddha's. So I got that going for me. Oh, let me see here. I'll tell you the story about my son and the buses. My son, When he was 2 years old, we lived for a short while in downtown Minneapolis. And he loved buses more than anything. And we lived in an apartment on the 7th floor overlooking Marquette Avenue. And Marquette is the street that during rush hour all the buses come down, all the commuter buses. So about an hour and a half of one bus right after another. And so my son used to stand on his bed and look out the window every afternoon, and he'd go, "Bus, bus, look, another bus, another bus, look." You know, and he would do this for, you know, an hour every day because he just loved those buses. What is it? It's a bus. It's another bus. And it was the most wonderful thing. And when his second birthday came around, we thought, well, let's go do something fun. Let's go to Uptown and let's take him on a bus, because that'll be really cool. And he will just, you know, he will love that. So we went over to Nicollet Avenue, and the bus pulls up, and Dean goes, "Bus! You know, bus!" He's all thrilled. And we picked him up and carried him on, got on the bus, and walked to our seats and sat down. And all of a sudden, he's just like this, you know. He's not interested in this at all. And we figured out he doesn't know he's on a bus. He's in a room full of people. Now, it's interesting, I think, that it moves. But to him, what is this bus? That's exciting. That's something. Wow. But he's been in a lot of rooms full of people. So that's not new to him. It's not interesting to him. It's not exciting to him. You know? So, once in a while, you can get on a bus and it feels fresh and new. You know, you ask yourself, what is it? And there's something really fresh and new about that bus experience. But I'm kind of with Dean as a baby. I get on that bus and I'm just in a room full of people, usually. But you don't have to be. You don't have to be. Trying to decide if I'm just going to keep going or if I'm going to get to the end and say what he said. Or maybe I should just leave you wondering. Let's see. Early on when I was first starting this practice, I remember people saying that if you meditate consistently over a period of time, you'll be able to see more clearly. And I heard that a lot. See, you'll be able to see more clearly. And I thought, well, that sounds wonderful. And I didn't know what that meant exactly. But it sounded, you know, it sounded pretty good. I thought, well, then I'll understand what's going on, what's happening in all situations. But that wasn't it, I don't think. I think it's true that one of the fruits of this practice can be that you see more clearly. And I think it's true in that you can, when you remember to, get the self out of the way when you're in a situation or when you're looking at something or when you're talking to somebody. And when you can do that, you see more clearly because you don't have the filters of your wants and your desires and your experiences and your hopes and your dreams and your fears getting in between you and what you're looking at. And the thing that we see more clearly is what the mind is doing. What the mind is doing. What's being cultivated here. I better get to what he said. So later, the monk went to see Wei Nung again. And when Wei Nung asked, "What is this?" he replied, "To say it is like something is not to the point." Sometimes it's translated as to say it is like something would miss the mark. But still, it can be cultivated. To say it is like something would miss the mark. There was an article this week in the New York Times somewhere about they were studying nostalgia, and I was fascinated by this article because during the course of reading the article, there were at least four or five or six different descriptions of what nostalgia was. And every single one of them just missed the mark. Just missed the mark. I mean, each one of us knows what nostalgia is, right? I mean, we all know what that feels like. But they tried every which way around it to describe it. And every one of them missed the mark. And so that was the monk's point there. If I were going to try to say what this I is, whatever I said would miss the mark. But still, I can cultivate the mind that is open to receiving the teachings and the practice and everything that goes into being whoever this person is in this moment as fully as I can. And then Wei Nung said, then should one engage in practice realization or not? And the monk replied, "It is not that there is no practice and realization, only that they cannot be defiled." So Wei Nung is asking him, is there this practice enlightenment, or isn't there? What are you doing here? And he said, "Well, it's not that there's no practice. It's not that there's nothing going on here. It's not that there's no enlightenment. It's not that we're just sitting here on the cushion trying to look like good monks. Only one that can't be defiled." And when he says be defiled, he says it can't be defiled. It can't be put into a little box that's defined by our clumsy attempts to pin it down, to say this is it. We can't defile it in that way. And I'm going to close with a poem from Dogen. So Dogen has got a number of verses in the Ehe Kuroku, verses praising ancient koans. And this is verse 59, where he's praising this koan. And Dogen says, "Having fully cooked all his stuff, this monk played with blowing winds and saw arising clouds, tasted the dragon's cry and loved the dragon's howl." So having fully cooked all his stuff, he spent 8 years cooking. He spent 8 years, you know, cooking his mind on the meditation seat in the monastery. Played with blowing winds and saw arising clouds. And so when the winds came in, he blew with them. When the clouds arose in his mind, he saw the clouds arise in his mind. He just went with it. "Tasted the dragon's cry and loved the dragon's howl." Now the dragon, it's interesting, it can stand for different things at different times. Sometimes it's used as a metaphor for enlightenment, and other times it's used as a metaphor for the self. So I read somewhere that meeting the dragon in the cave is a metaphor for confronting one's own deepest fears and obstacles. So, dragon is enlightenment, or your own deepest fears and obstacles. Same thing. So he tasted the cry of enlightenment and loved the howl of enlightenment. Or he tasted his own cry and loved his own howl as he was trying to work through this. I really like both of those. I think they're wonderful. "Single-mindedly striving, for 8 years refining gold, dropping body, did he clearly get it or not? For 8 years he was there at the monastery refining his gold. Dropping body, some of you know where that comes from. That's Dogen's teacher Ruzhing's phrase that that gave Dogen his enlightenment experience. Did he clearly get it or not? Did the monk clearly get it or not? This is so Dogen. He's got to evaluate the guy. You know, you're going, "Oh no, you're not going to say he didn't get it, are you?" Dogen is just like that. Did he clearly get it or not? What is this thus come and thus appeared? That's the question. What is it? The mind before your father and mother were born. What is it that's standing out on the porch waving goodbye? It's your grandmother's 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 grandmother. It's the universal cry of sorrow when people leave. Although directly attaining the wonder right now, Vipassana Buddha maintained this mind before. So, although the monk directly attained his realization right there in the monastery, Vipassana Buddha, who is the sixth, I don't want to say mythological, but the sixth sort of mytho-historical Buddha before the current Buddha, Vipassana Buddha maintained this mind before. So although the monk is directly attaining the wonder right now, this wonder has always been here. The Buddhas have always understood this wonder. So, I think I'm going to stop right there. So, anybody want to say anything or talk about something or sing a song? Ask a question.
I guess when I was looking at the world, I feel like everything refers to me in a way. Mm. I feel like I'm sort of like spread out through everything.
Mm.
In different ways, because there's first of all, like the way you can look at an object and you associate it with yourself, and you can realize that that object is you to your mind, or what you normally think of as being you. But then there's also the literal sense that when I look at something, like, you're there because I'm here, and whatever is behind that wall is not there because that wall is there. So it's like literally like a perspective thing.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like everything refers itself back to me.
Mm-hmm.
So when I make the attempt to follow that and like find out where it refers, I get the feeling, and this might be over like intellectualizing it, but I get the feeling that it's not. Mm-hmm. That it's like a infinitely like condensed point that it's not.
That you are an infinitely condensed point?
Yeah.
Oh. And what would happen if you let go of that infinitely condensed dot?
Well, I feel like there's
And yet you're referring to the things around you in relation to yourself.
Right.
Which is what we have to do. I mean, we walk around like those dogs that have the things on, and this is all we can see is from this perspective, right?
Yeah, that's kind of your impression. Everything kind of refers itself back to you.
Mm-hmm. It feels a lot better when you get out of that perspective once in a while, I think. And we can't stay out of that perspective all the time. I mean, we have to feed ourselves and, you know, pay our library fines and things. But I think it's an interesting exercise, and also a very helpful thing to do, to try to just totally put aside that whole notion of the world as reflected from me. To see if you can just put aside that whole idea of this me and see what that feels like. You're looking at me like I looked at the Zen teacher. Or I imagine you are. Sorry. It's hard stuff, I think. No self. It's very hard stuff.
No self.
Yeah.
That's how I feel.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not even easy to talk about.
No, it's not.
You've already missed it.
That's
right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It all reminds me of Wayne's poem.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you remember that. Because I would get the wording wrong. Or the first poem in his response.
Yeah, about the mirror. There is no Bodhi tree, there is no mirror bright. Something, something, so where does this dust alight? Yeah. Anybody remember that, what something, something was? Do ron, ron, ron. There's something. Yeah. They're not the same, no. Yeah, what does this mean is a really interesting question, too. But it's a very different question. It's a really different question.
Are they really different questions? I mean, it seems like you can ask, who am I? Who is God? Who is dog?
Uh-huh.
You kind of come to the same conclusion.
Well, I think if you ask, what is this? You're looking very particularly at what is going on right here in this immediate moment of my experience, you know? And sometimes you find out things like, you start off thinking, what is this? Well, I'm cranky. And then you go, no, what is this? And you find out that really you're anxious. Or you're worried. You know, and then if you want, you can go off into, you know, who is this that's worried? Who is this that's anxious? But you can... This is a very Joko Beck thing. Joko Beck was a Zen teacher who would have people, when they were sitting, emotions would arise, and she would ask them to identify them. And then they would work with those emotions. And I don't quite go that as far as she does with the analyzing the emotions part of it. But the thing that her students did learn to do was to figure out what it was they were feeling. And that's a really hard thing for a lot of people to do. And I don't know that you would get there by asking, what is dog? Maybe. I don't know if I would, but you might. All right, we have some announcements.